I'm really glad that Pat Davies could come and join us here to give a presentation on some of the activities that she's been involved in around health record banks, new approaches to consumer-controlled health information, to allow her maximum time for presentation and maximum time for question and answer, plus completing of the course evals. What I'll do is minimize the intro. Jack provided a beautiful background on her, a beautiful bio and background on her, and a nice little paragraph about the talk. So without further ado, thanks, Jack.
Great. Thanks, Peter. Thanks for having me today. Come over from the hinterlands in eastern Washington, in Spokane. I work with a company called Inland Northwest Health Services. Some of you may have heard of, some not. I thought I would talk about that briefly before I go into health record banks. We're a not-for-profit healthcare organization. We provide shared services to hospitals and physician offices. By shared services, I mean we run things that they find too expensive to run individually. The regional air ambulance service, considered comparable to your air flight, whatever the air one that's over here. We have a rehabilitation hospital for inpatient rehab. We also operate information technology systems for hospitals and physician offices, and that's really our major operation. We have run the information systems for 34 hospitals around the region, many of them critical access hospitals. We also run electronic medical record systems for physician offices. Both of those are run on a centralized model where we can operate them internally on behalf of the hospitals and physician offices. So we've been doing this for about 15 years now. Have been growing dramatically. Most of that is activities in eastern Washington, northern Idaho, but we also support some hospitals in Alaska and physician offices in Wyoming and in other parts of the country, so we are spreading out. What I'm going to be talking about this morning is the patient side of the picture. This is a quote from the federal IT plan that was developed under the first iteration of the Office of the National Coordinator of Health Information Technology about 2 years ago. And as part of the IT plan, and something you may have been hearing with the national IT agenda, is bringing the patient to the center, the idea of patient-focused healthcare. And how does that translate to informatics? Well, the idea of making health information available when and where it's needed, included available to and by the patient whenever it's needed. But a lot of a group talking about patient-focused healthcare go beyond just making it available. They talk more and more about patient control over their health information. So the ability for the patient to decide who gets to see their data and who doesn't, and down to a very granular level. Okay, I want to let my primary care provider see my immunization data, but I don't want them to see my STD history. Those kinds of things. Now, pragmatically, in a paper-based world, patients do the same thing. There's always the ability to, because of our wonderfully complex health system, there's always the ability to disguise your health information if you want to, but this would put it on a different level. Now, the idea of having the patient control and have access to their health information is one of those things, like most of health IT, that is a great sounding concept. And like most of IT, health IT, it's remarkably complex to implement. And the complexity is not so much technological, but it's really due to the culture of our healthcare system. And we dove into this in a big way when we began a little over a year ago to implement what we've called a health record bank. We're one of three communities in Washington State that received funding from the Washington State Healthcare Authority to test this concept out. The other two are Wenatchee and Bellingham. And the idea was to try pulling data out of a clinical electronic medical record and making it available through a personal health record system. So we developed a health record bank, a sort of data source, a mechanism for pulling the data out of a clinical electronic medical record system. And we partnered with Google Health. You may have heard both Google Health and Microsoft has a Health Vault product. Both of those are the two largest mainstream efforts to make a personal health record available that can allow aggregation of data from different sources. Our focus, at least getting started, was strictly on medications and allergies, and I'll go more into that in a little bit later about why we kept it so narrow. And we went with Google Health because we wanted it to be fast. We had a fairly short time for getting this project up and running. We wanted to do some evaluation and see how people liked it, both the providers and the consumers. And we wanted to see what we would run into in pulling data from different data sources. We looked at Health Vault, and I recognize I'm on the west side of the state here, so I've got to be careful about how I talk, but we looked at Health Vault, and our technical folks looked at the APIs for Health Vault versus for Google Health and decided it was just going to take way too much time to try to get the Health Vault piece figured out, that Google Health would be much easier. That was borne out because the other two sites, Wenatchee and Bellingham, did go with Health Vault, and it took them about 9 months longer to get data up and running than it did for us, and that was with a great deal of Microsoft's help. So that doesn't mean that we actually do want to connect to Health Vault eventually, but as I said, under our time frame, it was something that it was easy. We wanted to go easy first, so we went with Google Health, obviously because of the name recognition and the ease. And then we picked three clinics over in the Spokane area to partner with us, invited them to partner. One is a large multi-specialty clinic called Rockwood. Also, Physicians Clinic of Spokane, which is an internal medicine practice, and then Heart Clinics Northwest, which is a cardiology practice. Our intent was to really look at two different patient populations. One with the large multi-specialty practice would really be representative of the general population. Families, young adults, older people, across the board. The other one was very much an older population and a strong referral relationship between those two practices. The internal medicine group refers people to the cardiology group. Now, all three of these practices are using the same electronic medical record system, the same product, the GE Centricity product, which you may have heard of before. But two of them are using the GE Centricity version that we at INHS run on their behalf. One of them, Rockwood, the large group, is using their own flavor. They installed it and they run it themselves. Now, think about everything you've been hearing in the news about health information exchange and about all the importance of moving data from point A to point B. We picked the easiest case scenario, the same product going to an easy personal health record source. Okay, keep that in mind. We also set up advisory committees both on the provider side and the consumer side to talk about, understand what they were concerned about, what they were interested in, and to give us guidance as we got it going. If you haven't looked at Google Health or any of these personal health records, really what they entail is a user interface where people can look at their information, can import it from different sources or just hand enter it, change it, delete it, and print it out. Google is set up already where you can pull data in from different sources. Most of the national pharmacies are linked up to Google, so I pull in my Walgreens data from my into my Google Health account. There's increasingly some large national, like Cleveland Clinic, some of the insurance plans, others are beginning to use these as a way for patients to get access to their data. Google also has the ability to do health information web searches. So the concept is that if you are diagnosed with diabetes, that information will come from your healthcare provider into your account, and then you can immediately start doing web searches based on the information that you have. Our health record bank, and I'll show you a few pictures of this, but you can also see this in Google. You can go in when you set up an account, and you can identify, there's a place where you can go import medical records. And so we defined a new place to import medical records. We called it One Health Record, with a number one health record. So if you go into Google Health and look, and you look at the list of clinical data sources, you'll see right at the top of the list. And that was a very smart move by our marketing people, because by the number one, we're at the top of the list. Otherwise, it's alphabetical, and we would have been who knows where. But the idea was to make it easier for people to find. And that both for the patients, you know, most people don't go to a single health, other than group health, to a single healthcare organization for a long period of time. So they have their data all over the place. And we wanted to make it easy for people to put their data in one place. We did recognize Google is rather interesting. And again, this is, you can speculate and have all kinds of long philosophical discussions about the differences between Google and Microsoft. But Google puts all of the requirements for management, authentication, privacy, and security at the end of where the data comes from. Microsoft has built all of that into the Health Vault environment, which is part of the reason why it was so much easier to connect to Google than to Microsoft. So we had to essentially construct that piece, how to authenticate, how to make sure we were connecting up the right data and so forth. So we built this system, and we pulled the data from the clinics. This is just a high-level picture of what I just described. It mentions the clinics. Actually, it also mentions hospitals, because we already had interfaces set up from the hospitals in our region where they automatically export data when a patient is hospitalized. Information about that patient's inpatient visit is already automatically uploaded into the EMRs in these physician offices. And then, so we deal with all of these front-end aspects after we pull the data from the EMRs and upload it to somebody's Google Health account. I'm going to focus a little bit on just the technology, or the not the technology so much because I'm not a technologist, but the some of the policy decisions we had to make and how it ended up being reflected in the application, and then talk a little bit more about what we've learned in this process. We did, as I said, have to build this whole authentication security piece ourselves. And that got us to our first step of the new reality of trying to do this. Again, why it's so much harder to actually implement an application like this than to actually, and then the technology applies. The doctors and the patients are, of course, very, very concerned about making sure that nobody gets access to somebody's health information except the person who should have access to it. How do you guarantee that? And how do you guarantee that in a way that doesn't require everybody to show up in the front of you with your ID and a notarized record signature and so on? And how do you link to a record in different EMRs? What we ended up doing after talking both to the doctors and the patients was coming up with a multi-step process, and we recognize it as a clumsy process. We are well aware of that, but it was in some ways deliberately clumsy, where we have people register, and in order to register, they have to have a PIN, a personal identifier number, that they have gotten from their physician office. In order to get the PIN, they have to fill out a form for authorizing release of the health information. Essentially, we modeled the paper-based process that everyone uses now when they're releasing information from one practice to another. The change was the what happened after the office gets that form. So the office gets the form, and then they match it to the person's medical record, and then they generate a letter that's got a PIN, and they mail that to the person's home address, the address that is in their database. So that was one way of just making sure we were sending PINs to the right people, because there had to be a match of information, and it had to work with what they had in their database. Interestingly, two of the clinics were fine with this release of information form being faxed in. One of them did want to see the driver's license and the form and everything all together. You know, they didn't have to do that for paper-based records, but they had to do that for electronic records. Just one of the interesting things. So people would go through this process, setting up this account. When they had their PIN, we made a deliberately painful form that they had to fill out because we wanted to make sure they really wanted to do this. And so just entered a few pieces of information in addition to the PIN, gender, date of birth, and the last four digits of Social Security.
Jeff, just to clarify one thing, you said that the clinics had slightly different processes. So if you were seen in both practices, you had to do this twice?
Yes. And again, that's part of the deliberately kludgy. We recognize that there are many ways we could have made this much more seamless. And interestingly, the patients, as part of our evaluation, have said they want it easier. The providers wanted it hard because they were very concerned about liability. They wanted to make sure that they were only releasing it to people who could deserve it.
I just wonder the extent to which you use common conventions. I mean, in this process of just setting it up and getting the demographic segment in place to build everything else on, how did you agree on all that? There are informatics standards with regards to electronic health records and personal health records. I'm curious to the extent to which you were using those.
We looked at them and used them where we could, but we yielded particularly to the physician's wishes because we had to get the physicians to buy into this. Now, we have these three practices we picked. We weren't picked at random. They are all reasonably informatics savvy. We're lucky in Spokane where we've got a high level of geek doctors in the community. We've got a 60 to 70% EMR adoption in Spokane, which is much higher than in most parts of the country. And so they knew what they were doing, but even that population was very nervous by this whole process. So once they set up their account, they got their PIN, they could go in, and the concept, this only shows one, this shows Heart Clinics Northwest, but the concept is that they could go to, they did see all three clinics, they could pick which ones they wanted to get data from, and eventually they could pick multiple categories. If they wanted to receive allergies and medications, and later we intend to have up their lab results and diagnoses and other data types. So that this is sort of a managing process. This is where they could have at least some level of granularity in what data they wanted to show people. This is what the patient sees. This next screen shows what the providers see. Again, the providers wanted a multi-step process. So they didn't want us to just automatically start releasing data, even though they got the PIN from the person. They wanted to have a final approval process where they could make absolutely sure that they were linking up the right information. So this is a screen that just shows what all the requests that are essentially in a provider's queue. That this assumes that people have asked for access to both Heart Clinics and Physicians Clinic, and each of those clinics can go in and can say, yes, I agree that this person is who they say they are, and yes, I will release this information. The way we did that is, although this looks like a single screen, this data is actually coming from two different sources. This information is coming from what they entered in that login form, what they entered when they registered into one health record bank. This information is actually being pulled out of the clinic centricity system for that patient. And so there's a one final last in-person look. Yes, these last four digits match. Yes, this birth date matches, and so forth. And then there is an approval process. The clinic can either approve or deny. If they deny, there's a way that they can put some information into it, and that goes out to the patient in an email. The denial might be, there's one digit off in your Social Security, I just wanted to check and make sure, those kinds of things. I mentioned in the development process that we had both physicians and consumers involved, and it's been fascinating hearing the different concerns by the groups. The patients alternate between, give us all of our data. What do you know? Of course we have the right to control our data. And what do you mean if you're going to release this to Google Health? And it did not help that while we were working on this, there was a very large blow up where Beth Israel back on the East Coast had worked out a deal with Google Health and was releasing information, patient information, to Google Health's account, just like we were trying to do. But they used claims data. They didn't use the clinical data. It didn't come out of their information system. It came out of their billing system. Well, the problem with that is that what gets billed isn't necessarily what gets diagnosed. So this blew up when a very intelligent, very informatics savvy blogger used the system and found that he had all kinds of diagnoses that he really didn't know he had, like cancer. And he was a little bit curious about that. And so what they found was that, of course, whenever his clinicians ordered a rule-out test, it was still billed as a test. And that was a big lesson for us and also for Google. Inevitably, even though it was Beth Israel's fault because they made a stupid decision about where the data came from, Google got blamed. So we had a lot of discussion back and forth with the physicians, with the patients, on what is this information going to mean, what should be available to you. We reached agreement on this registration and authentication process. The physicians were comfortable with it. The patients, by and large, thought they were fine with it just happening automatically. They didn't want to go through all these steps. We figured out the technical process for pulling the data out of the electronic medical record systems. We got our security and privacy policies in place. We actually did a security audit. Our IT group was nervous about working with Google too, simply because of the risk of exposure. We have a very large database. As I said, we run the information system for 34 hospitals, and we have well over 2 million patient records representing most of the population of Eastern Washington and Northern Idaho in that data set. And so they just wanted to make absolutely sure we weren't opening some back doors to get into that. And then we did a lot of testing and training of clinic staff. So where we are now, we went live a year ago, March of 2009. we started slowly, focusing on our own staff and also the staff at the three clinics, with an idea that it would help them to understand it, it would help them to be proponents of it if they were using it themselves. We set up a number of people to call, we made clinics to the visits, visits to the clinics, to provide training and assist with enrollment. And again, we found right off the bat from our own staff that we knew that this idea of online personal health records has got a while before it's going to be fully accepted. My own husband will not sign up for an account. I set up one because I sort of felt obliged to, and actually I think it's kind of cool. My husband refuses to because he's concerned about his privacy. And it's that kind of mixed reaction across the board. We also did some marketing in the local media, put materials in the clinics, mailed letters to the patients. We did some after we had that initial cohort of our own staff, we then began pushing it out to patients. And I will confess at this point that our enrollment after a year is a grand total of around 250. Excuse me. Which is, again, begs a lot of questions about, are personal health records really that desirable? If we've been pushing this as much as we have and we've got 250 people to sign up for it, what is that telling us? Of those 250 people, the majority of them are women, a little bit older. That may be because of the demographics of the clinics that we chose, although, as I said, actually most of those 250 did come from that large multi-specialty clinic because they've been pushing it more than the other two have. Most of them are people, they found the enrollment process pretty easy. They didn't want to have it done entirely online. They didn't see the reason for all the steps we built in. And they all considered themselves to be managers of their own health. Now, when we had people enroll, one of the things that we did was have them do a survey, which included some questions about self-actualization, the idea of patient ownership of their own health, and how involved they were, how engaged they were in their own health care. Our idea being that we would test that at baseline and then test that at a year out. So we haven't yet done that second step yet. But one of our theories is that this is going to increase patient involvement in healthcare, in their own healthcare, interest and engagement. I've got just a couple of slides to talk about from a clinic perspective why they would want to do this. And I've also got to step you back on time a little bit. We went live March of 2009, so we started the conversations in late 2008. It wasn't until we were actually, after we were up and running, that the whole meaningful use definition stuff happened, and I don't know if you've talked about that or are aware of that, but the idea of the federal requirements that will increase a physician's or a hospital's reimbursement if they are using health information technology meaningfully. And there's this extremely complex definition of what meaningful is. One piece of that definition is making data available directly to patients. So we started this before the whole meaningful use thing came out. And so when the clinics decided to participate, that was not part of their decision. The clinics did participate because they did want, even without that federal pressure, they wanted to offer patients access to their health information, and they wanted to get patients more engaged in their health care. They were interested, again, the groups over in Spokane are very good about collaboration. So they wanted to be involved in this community pilot because it was a piece of health information exchange. And then after we got going and the whole meaningful use thing came out, they realized that they had a jump start now. They were going to be, this was one of the things that was going to help them meet their meaningful use definition by being able to push data out to patients. What they found, and this was the very large clinic that gave me this perspective, is that this is a real challenge in a large healthcare organization. And again, it's not the technology, it's the people side. It's hard to engage patients. It was hard to engage staff in a lot of ways. When you have got 20 clinic sites around a community, how do you get all of the front office staff trained to be able to answer questions about this new project? It was hard to get physicians to agree to inform their patients about it because the physicians had very mixed feelings. It's a new concept, releasing information directly out of the medical record to the patient. Some of the people were concerned about privacy, and some of them were disappointed that there wasn't more than allergies and medications. So I'm going to go through some of the key issues that we've encountered and just talk about why this has broader implications beyond just personal health records. This has got implications for all of these health information exchange initiatives that are being promoted now. Authentication and registration, again, we felt the clinics needed to be comfortable with the process. We had a different framework than the Wenatchee and Bellingham projects did. They were very much patient-centric, appropriately so. They were very, very focused on getting people signed up to use this. We were coming at it from the perspective of the clinicians because that's really where our experience base is. And we wanted to make sure that the clinicians were comfortable with the process because we felt that if they didn't buy into it, there was no point in doing it at all. If they weren't going to release the data. We did decide to mirror the process they use for release paper records. And we gave them the final control over that release, that last check where they could say accept. And all of those were necessary to, as I said, the buy-in process. I mentioned the security audit. That was something that we wanted to do because we wanted to make sure that we weren't creating new vulnerabilities. Patient control over health information. This was fascinating. Because, you know, the first slide, I was talking about how this is a major theme in health reform, patient-centric healthcare, patient control over health information. The physicians were very concerned about relying on information that the patients have total control over. That if this is the mechanism of health information exchange, where patients can edit a record before it goes over to the physician said pretty bluntly, we're not going to rely on it. So unless I know absolutely that you've had this test done over here, and I know that you haven't changed the results of that test, I'm going to order that test again. And that's, there's here in Washington State, partly the Healthcare Authority funded this pilot to test this concept because there was some thinking that this health record bank could be the mechanism for clinical health information exchange, that we didn't need these other mechanisms of information exchange. We just had to have this patient control. All the data would go into a person's health vault or Google Health account or whatever, and then the person would decide and release it over to the clinicians. Well, this was the big red flag. You can do that, but the clinicians then, you're probably going to be seeing more and more redundant testing and other things going on because their clinicians are not going to rely on it. One thing about this in terms of patient control, even with the Google Health, it does show where the data came from and whether it's been changed. So you can see if the data came from Walgreens or from One Health record or whatever. And you can see whether it's user entered or came from a clinical source. Liability, inevitably in healthcare, was an issue that came up. They were concerned about what if this information is misused? And what about timing? The cardiology group was especially interested in this because they've got some patients, of course, who are on medications that need to be updated frequently. The dosage and the treatment is updated all the time. And so what if a person goes into an ED and they have their printout from their Google Health account and it doesn't have the latest information of what their current dosage is? And so the ED treats them in a way inappropriately if something bad happens. So who's liable? They did recognize that concern is present whether the information is electronic or on paper. And if you think about it, a lot of these things are bringing up, these are problems that already exist. It's just people think about it differently if it's electronic. And again, when we put up the policy documents we put together, we talk very clearly about the limits of clinic's responsibility. And so it was very clear that once the information leaves the EMR and gets into somebody's Google Health account, it's the patient's responsibility. And if it gets changed there or if it gets used by somebody else, then the originating clinic doesn't have responsibility for that. Now, we haven't had that tested in court, but that was our intent. This was the biggest eye-opener, and we kind of expected it, but it was interesting to have it confirmed. I mentioned that all three clinics were using GE Centricity. Two of them were using the product that we manage on their behalf. one of them was using a separate product. Every one of them uses it differently. And within a practice, physicians use it differently. So this idea of standardization and getting everybody on EMRs, and the fact that if everybody's on EMRs, you're going to be able to do health information exchange, well, that's a little simplistic. There's a lot more that needs to happen to make health information exchange possible. They each have implemented it a little bit differently. They use it differently within their practices. How data is captured affects this. And this was just so bizarre. When we first began doing HL7 messaging, which is the basis for moving that we're using to move the information out of the EMR, and I don't know if you've I'm making a lot of assumptions about your basic level of knowledge here, so I see heads nod, which is good. When we first did our test messages, we found that they were dying. They weren't making it all the way to Google Health. And when we investigated, what we found was there were some physicians who were, instead of entering codes for medications, were typing it in and were using, for some reason, a divider line. And if you know HL7 format, the divider line has significance in the format. So the HL7 interface, it wasn't able to read it, and so the message was dying. Well, that was just one physician in this practice that was doing that. You know, those are the kinds of things you just wouldn't think about. It's also what was interesting as they began thinking about what are the implications when what they type into the record becomes directly available to the patient. Well, you think, we started with allergies and medications. Simplest case scenario. Simplest both in terms of data translation, you know, those are pretty reasonably codified, but also simplest in terms of interpretation, you would think. But there were physicians in some of these practices who were worried because instead of just typing in the name of the medication in the field, they would type in, I think this person might be a drug abuser. Okay. Now, in the medication field. Now, imagine that being automatically exported over into the person's personal health record. So that gave them pause. And if you think about it, at least on a larger scale, is this going to influence how they record information? Is this going to influence the encounter if physicians are having to start to mentally edit what they're entering into the record because they know the patient's going to see it directly? Now, I have to admit, I've since had conversations with some people at Group Health where they've actually been doing this for a number of years. And they said that the very same issues came up for their doctors when they implemented their My Group Health system and began pulling data out of their medical record. The same issues came up, and at least in their system, it really turned into being a non-issue. There weren't problems with interpreting the data. Patients were very happy with it. The physicians ended up being very comfortable with it. But that's a group health is not exactly a typical healthcare environment. So, you know, I don't know how that translates to the real world, so to speak. Workflow was interesting. Healthcare organizations are workflow is everything, and they're very, very focused and they're very comfortable with certain workflows. Well, if you've got somebody who comes in with a form that says, look, I've got all the information for you right here. I don't need to fill out your pad, your form, you know, that everybody has to fill out every time you go into the doctor's office. The front desk doesn't know what to do with that. They don't know what to do with this form that's got everything on it. And so there needs to be training about that. The same thing. We had one patient participating in this who happened to go to the ED. A wonderful man. He was the first one who said to the doctor in the ED, look, all this is in my Google Health account. Here, you've got a computer sitting right there. Just pull it up and look at it. And the doctor said, are you kidding? No, just answer my questions. So there's a lot of cultural change that's going to have to happen. And part of that is the doctor-patient relationship. There's going to have to be changes in how they interact and where the information comes from and how accepting they are of that information. The front office staff need to be exchanged. And the organizations all have to be willing to accept information from each other more so than they are now. There's a lot of discussions now there was at the HIMSS meeting last week, our CEO sat in on a panel talking about trust relationships in health information exchange. And that's going to be a huge component. We've been focusing, we've had this paper-based mindset for the last century or so. And now when you start seeing data coming from lots of different sources, and those sources are not the hospital down the street that you're used to working to, but it's a hospital across the country, is that going to change your trust for that information? The consumer engagement piece, as I'm wrapping up here, is the last thing that we really focused on. I mentioned our big hefty grand total of 250 people. The numbers at the other two sites are not a whole lot larger, although they do have a couple more data types in their system. We have found that it has to be actively and aggressively promoted to get people to sign on. Not only are people not used to keeping a personal health record, people are not used to managing their own health information, period. By and large, I mean, unless you're a mother that's been keeping your kids' vaccinations tables, most people don't think about managing their own health information. So that's a cultural shift that has to happen. There are privacy concerns because it's electronic. And how much information is enough to create value? Well, it's pretty apparent that medications and allergies are not enough. You know, those are not things that change very often. Our intention for this year is to add other data types. So we are going to try to move into lab results, immunizations, diagnoses, a few other data types, and see if that will increase interest and participation. And it's just educating the consumer is so important. And this is part of just changing the dynamic in healthcare. So with that, questions?
So I have a question, which is, because this is different, quite different than the uptake that has occurred with things like My Group Health or the UW Patient Portal or the Vanderbilt Patient Portal, which are different because you're getting a view that you can't edit of a relatively complete subset of the medical record. How many of the people of the 215 in your study hold data from more than one place? In other words, for how many people would there be a substantive difference between a personal health record that they're not putting data into but are just sucking data down into versus, say, a portal to that same institution?
Most people have at least three data types. Data they get themselves, you know, the over-the-counter meds and all the rest of that. Data from one of the pharmacies and data from the at least one clinical source. We don't have many that have got data from two clinical sources yet. But this is the larger picture. Yes, and it's, again, gets to the complexity of our system. I mean, there's a reason why institutions have held on to their information. It's part of tying the patient to the organization. But if you've got a community like Spokane where there isn't a single dominant provider, people do go to multiple providers. And it's just going to make sense to have that data come in from different sources.
Sure. Well, no, I was just wondering if one of the differences, I think, in uptake has been that there's a very rich set of data available all about your care if you're tied to an organization, particularly Group Health or Vanderbilt, where they are sole providers, largely sole providers. So I was just wondering, because the numbers one to two log order difference in the places that have pushed out portals.
I just also want to keep in mind, Group Health has been doing, and most of those portals have been going for 4 or 5 years, mm-hmm. I mean, or at least.
Yeah.
So we're still early stages. It's a little bit of our defense. So, go back here.
Did you look at issues of dropout along the path? I mean, you talked about how cumbersome and awkward it was for patients to sign up because they put all these barriers in place. Is there anything on, like, how many lost along the way because they had to physically go into the office to show their ID or any of those other kinds of issues that could influence?
We don't have data on people who just looked at it and didn't get started at all. Of those who got started, pretty much they all completed it. But these are the people who really already have a high level of self-actualization, already well engaged. So I don't know that that's totally representative of the population. So,
So when we talk about sort of patient health portals like this, you know, there's the sort of positive takeaways that people talk about, and like, you have all this information between you and your doctor, and you can update it all these things. How does that sort of set of positive takeaways overlap with maybe what the patients are reporting to you, what they're getting out of it? Is it the same thing? Are they coming and saying everything you told me is shaping up, or are they kind having sort of a novel positive experience, or they not seeing those tingling?
It's a mixture. There are patients who are delighted with it and are seeing a really great, we're seeing a good response to it. I gave a talk to a group of senior citizens in Spokane, and many of them who were on it because they're patients at the internal medicine practice, and they were all encouraging their colleagues there to join it because they said, this is just so nice to have this information. On the other hand, and this gets back to the provider concerns, the patients are doing a little bit more challenging. And that was one of the questions. Are they going to get more phone calls? When the patient gets this, shows information pops up in their Google Health account, is the office going to be inundated with phone calls asking questions? That's another reason why we didn't go past allergies and medications. Because when they start getting into lab results or diagnoses, is that going to cause more confusion? And we haven't gotten there yet. We're not far enough along to know if that's really an issue. So there were some other questions. Let me go back here.
I'm curious, when the Healthcare Authority first came up with the health underbank model, it was really prior to considering Google Health or health farm. And one of the big question was the revenue model in the business case. It was not clear that patients would be willing to pay for this, nor that organizations would be willing to fund the infrastructure to put in place. Does that disappear if you use Google? How do you see this down the long term in terms of business case?
It doesn't disappear because, as with any case where you have an interface, there's maintenance costs over time. And we don't know that Google and Health Vault are going to be free forever. You know, what's the business model there? Well, the other thing, though, that has changed is meaningful use. So because of the meaningful use regulations are written such that providers will get an additional reimbursement for a period of about 5 years if they're meeting the definition. After that time period, it becomes the stick that they will get less reimbursement if they're not meeting the definition. So it will become in providers' best interest, and because making the data available to the patients is one of those requirements, it's going to be in their best interest to fund some kind of patient access. And the meaningful use is written such that the first deadline, which is in 2011, is written so that you only have to give the patient an electronic copy of their record if they ask for it. So that can be on a flash drive or a CD or something. But the 2013 deadline says specifically the data has to be dumped more or less in real time into their PHR. Now just the caveat being that the meaningful use definition has not been finalized. That's in the draft. That seems to be the direction they're going.
I'd like to ask you the extent to which the data that you have in your personal health record bank and the electronic health record bank has been looked at with respect to the quote competency profiles that IOM 203 mentioned with regard to the different specialty disciplines. And they said that there should be some common ground in, you know, relating those, and that also brings up issues relating not only to practitioner competencies, but how you educate patients to have competencies in using what's conveyed to them. So I was wondering the extent to which you quote that.
Not at all. What we're doing is getting our feet wet, and literally in testing what are the issues that we see in moving data to the patients. The provider side and provider competency is an interesting question because I think that's part of the driver behind some of the discrepancies I talked about in using the EMRs. You know, the providers don't always understand why it's important that they intercodify data rather than just typing it in. And they're much more focused on getting through the encounter. They've got their 15 minutes, they've got to talk to the patient, and adding the typing in is...
But the whole thing that you're pointing to is related to what the IOM 203 pointed out. There are five core competencies. Patient-centered care, multidisciplinary teams, evidence-based practice, quality management, enabled by informatics, i.e. structures of these things like EHR and EHRs. And you have to develop that into the whole educational process, which not only includes practitioner competencies, which they were focused on, but as you pointed out, the resulting patient competencies in understanding what the practitioner is conveying to them to guide their lifestyle. And I'm just curious to the extent to which you're looking at the structure of these health data banks as a vehicle, you know, for that whole framework, which is really the fundamental picture of the basic care scenario in healthcare information.
Why don't we take the answer to that offline, because we have enough time for maybe another one or two questions, and then we have to get the evaluations.
No, I appreciate that. You're right, though, that kind of education on both sides needs to happen.
Yeah. How much longer is the fake state funding for this, and what other research questions are you going to try to answer in the next several months?
We've got another year of funding, which we just found out about 2 weeks ago. And our main interest is going to be seeing, we're actually, because of meaningful use, we've got people coming to us now, hospitals in particular, asking if they can come on. So we're going to see if other data sources, like hospitals, and if other data types, particularly the lab results and immunizations, if that increases our uptake.
Maybe you said it, but can parents get the data for their kids?
That was another interesting point. And we punted and limited it to people 18 and over. And part of that was because of the concern, and there's the, in Washington, parents can access their children's records up to the age of 13. Between 13 and 18, parents cannot get access to that information. And then after 18, the person can set up their own account. So the other site, two sites, set up a process to allow for validation of a child under the age of 13 so the parent can set up an account for them. That's something we also, speaking of coming here, we do want to address because we also want to see if that will increase our uptake.
I was also wondering, can you take a Google, have you looked at when you're in Google Health, if you have a patient that's like a parent-child relationship, Can that child become its own entity? Is there a way to do that? Did you know?
Google, I don't recall.
Okay, sorry.
Google actually has somewhat limited functionality. And so, Bill, you're the last one.
You mentioned different data types several times, diagnoses, immunizations, and I can think of different arguments why some of those would be interesting to look at because they're going to differ coming from sources or other ones might represent particular value propositions to, you know, parent to families where you want to have child immunization records. And I'm curious how you're going to decide what to go after next. How are you going to decide?
It's probably going to be driven primarily by pragmatism, to be very blunt. What's the next low hanging fruit? And that's probably going to be immunizations because the other two sites have already worked on interfaces with the state child profile registry. And so we don't have to go to the clinics to get that immunization data. But that raises your point about the children's records.
All right. Thanks very much.
All right. Thank you.